The following episode contains mature content. Parental discretion is advised for any listeners under the age of 18.
Mea culpa, a letter from Dylan Thomas to Marguerite Caetani. The Boathouse, Larne, Carmarthenshire, Wales, 6th November 1952. My dear Marguerite Caetani, it was beautiful to have your letter, and it made me 100 times more ashamed, if that were possible, of my wretched, long, dark silence. Your letter was so warm and good, as though I had never been barbarously bad to you at all, and as though almost I was forgiven for the breaking of promises, the filthy discourtesy, incomprehensible to me also, even the whole dead year's dumb insult itself. It was beautiful to hear from you. I don't deserve one warm word, but only bashing on the head and then forgetting, cold as ice. I don't understand why I never wrote. Why I never wrote, if only to explain. To explain why I could not, at that time, in spite of my promises, finish the second half of my piece for you. Many times I began a letter and then put it aside because the piece was not finished. And the drafts of letters piled up and time lapped on and thickened, putting on skins of distance. And daily, and even more so nightly, I grew more ashamed of my silence and more angry with my procrastination until at last I couldn't write at all. I buried my head in the sands of America, flew over America like a damp, ranting bird, boomed and fiddled while home was burning, carried with me all the time my unfinished letters, my dying explanations and self-accusations, my lonely half of a loony maybe play in a heavy, hurtful bunch. These ostrich griefs were always with me and whispered loudest in the late night when indeed I was all sand.
Put it off. Put it off.
It's too late now.
You can never be forgiven.
The past is as dead as you'll be.
Burn the daft drafts. Unwind the half play in your head so that nothing's left. Forget, you damned Welsh cake, for doom will nibble you down to the last loud crumb. Strangle your litter of wits in a sack and splash.
These agonbite deadeners did their long night worst. But the little voice in the dark, oh, throb, 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 it went across Kansas and in all the ovens of the hotel bedrooms. These pages, I think, are wilting in the grey, nearly permanent drizzle that sighs down onto this town and through the bird-scratched matchboard roof into my word-splashed hut. It isn't rain. It must be remorse. The whole fishy bay is soaked in guilt like the bad bits of poems not to be, oozing to the marrow on the matchsticked floor. And the half-letters curling and whining in the warped drawers. I'm writing this guilty noise in a cold pool on a November afternoon in mists of depression. Forgive me even for this, if you can. I find my pitiful wallow in the drizzle of regret and indulgence I can't pity. This weather gets me like poverty. It blurs and then blinds, creeps chalky and crippling into the bones, shrouds me in wet self, rains away the world. I can't explain why I didn't write to explain why I couldn't finish the piece. No, I can't explain. When I try to explain.
Whether the knife falls on the melon or the melon on the melon suffers.
She saw someone she did not wish to see. And was it because my reputation had outdistanced me?
In the last analysis,
I know how I would listen.
Desires always go far beyond the object of desire.
That's a memory, rich memory.
I remember being surprised that the Paris Review, you know, Paris Review, that's for real artists.
The Paris Review Podcast, Episode 15, Memory, Rich Memory, featuring a letter from Dylan Thomas to his editor, read by Sir Salman Rushdie, and two stories, one by Alexandra Kleeman, read by the author, and another by Paulette Barton, read by Devendra Banhart. And we begin with a poem by Sharon Olds.
Which would be me?
The solution. Finally, they got the singles problem under control. They made it scientific. They opened huge sex centers. You could simply go and state what you want, and they would find you someone who wanted that too. You would stand under a sign saying, "I like to be touched and held." And when someone came and stood under the sign saying, "I like to touch and hold," they would send the two of you off together. At first, it went great. A steady stream of people under the sign, "I like to give pain," paired up with the steady stream of people from under, "I like to receive pain." Foreplay only, no orgasm, found its adherence, and orgasm only, no foreplay, matched up its believers. A loyal Berkeley, California policeman stood under the sign, "Married adults, lights out, face to face, under a sheet." Because that's the way it was legal in Berkeley. But he stood there a long time in his lonely blue law coat. And the man under, "I like to be sung to while bread is kneaded on my stomach," had been there weeks without a reply. Things began to get strange. The love only, no sex, was doing fine. The sex only, no love, was doing really well. Pair after pair walking out together like wooden animals off a child's ark. But the line for 38D or bigger was getting unruly, shouting insults at the line for 8 inches or longer. And odd, isolated signs were springing up everywhere. Retired school teacher and parakeet, no leather. One room, no bath, view of sausage factory. The din rose in the vast room. The line under, "I want to be fucked senseless," was so long that portable toilets had to be added and a minister brought in for deaths, births, and marriages on the line. Over under, "I want to fuck senseless," no one, a pile of guns. A hollow roaring filled the enormous gym. More and more people began to move over to "want to be fucked senseless." The line snaked around the gym, the stadium, the whole town, out into the fields. More and more people joined it. Until "fucked senseless" stretched across the nation in a huge wide belt like the Milky Way. And since they had to name it, they named it. They called it the American Way. I didn't know anything about any worldly things about sex or anything. I was very innocent, very married and so happy. And so, I don't know if it sounds a little self-righteous or pompous. It's making fun. It's not the kindest poem I've ever written, but I was making it all up. I don't know how I even knew that something was going on somewhere that bore some relationship to some of this.
All that I can't explain. I was, as you know, leaving home, though I'm miraculously home again now in this tumbling house whose every broken pane and wind whipped off slate, child scrawled wall, rain stain, mouse hole, knobble and ricket, man booby and rat trap, I know in my sleep. I was leaving forever, it seemed. Had nowhere to go, nothing to go with. Putting off all the nasty time.
Fairy Tale by Alexandra Kleeman. I was sitting at a long table with a lot of nice things on it. There was a large pitcher of water with an ornate handle that looked like it was made of real silver, and there were forks and spoons. There were apples and small round appetizers and a big dead cooked goose. There were so many things that the table underneath was eclipsed entirely. The visible objects obscured even more food, more tableware beneath. My mother and father were sitting next to each other on the long side of the table, and a man I didn't recognize at all was sitting next to them. I sat across on the other end, alone. I was looking at all of the things and trying to notice connections between them. Why this table? Why now? Why these things, not others? Many of the things were round, except the goose. I tried looking from object to object. Fork, butter, spinach, hand, napkin, apple, cup. It was then that I noticed none of the others seated at the table were looking at the table or its contents. They were all looking at me. They were looking continuously. There was no sense that they would soon be looking away. They had these looks on their faces, especially the man. He had a look like he just would never ever get enough of looking. His eyes were like two little identical stones, the bare minimum of a face, just enough to make you look twice to check if you were looking at a person.
"You are announcing your engagement," said my father helpfully.
"To who?" I asked. I felt a strange sense of ownership for all the objects on the table, yet I did not want to claim them.
"To us," they said. "All of you?" I said. "No, only me," said the man in the button-up shirt, whom I did not recognize.
I find it increasingly difficult to speak of my feelings at will.
"I am announcing my engagement to you," I asked, gesturing at him. "Yes, exactly," he said, looking satisfied. It seemed impossible to phrase the question in a way that would yield a perfectly unambiguous answer.
"Who am I engaged to?" I asked.
"To me," he said, no longer looking satisfied.
The whole situation felt as unreal as something could, while also feeling sorely, mortally dangerous. It seemed to draw strength from my speech, as in, the more I spoke within it, accepting its premises, the more I spoke into it without screaming at it, the more it made me whomever this position demanded.
"Has anyone carved the goose?" I asked. "We better carve it before it gets cold or hard, before it reverses. We'd better do something before it changes."
"Stay on topic, darling, and try to be polite," my mother replied. "We were having a discussion, and it's only a family discussion if you participate." There was no way out. All the doors were far away and in the line of sight. "I don't think it's unrelated," I said, "or I don't think it's impolite. I am going to make one or both of those arguments," I said. My suitor looked at his watch.
"I think you're being difficult," my mother replied. "I think you should sit down and finish the announcement you started. There's ice cream for after the announcement, and it's already in the dishes, melting."
The doorbell rang, and I went to the door.
Standing outside was a man who looked almost entirely unfamiliar, like someone I had met maybe once through an acquaintance or a circumstantial friend. "Hi," he said. "Oh, hi," I replied. "Who are you?" I wanted to say. But instead, I just looked at him, at his medium-sized mouth, his large-sized nose, his normal-sized face. "I'm your boyfriend?" he said helpfully, holding up a fistful of flowers. I would have asked a follow-up question, but instead I felt myself begin to slow down as if I had been filled up with damp sand. I thought about the person in the other room who said he was my fiancé, and I wondered if I had been designed to function within this situation, or instead to somehow undo it. I remember a proverb that I once found carved into the body of an old tree. Whether the knife falls on the melon, or the melon on the knife, the melon suffers. "Oh, hi," I said. "Sweetheart?" I guided him into the kitchen and pointed him to the table. "Mother? Father? Fiancé?" I said. "This is my boyfriend." My fiancé immediately began to look uncomfortable, but did not voice this discomfort except by a soft gurgling sound in the throat. I seated the boyfriend across from the fiancé and watched. Perhaps they would cancel each other out. "How do you do?" said the boyfriend to each member of the table in turn. He shook my father's hand, kissed my mother's, and nodded sharply to my fiancé. The gurgling escalated, but my mother politely switched on the dishwasher, and soon we heard mostly the sound of machinery rather than that of a person's feelings surfacing. "He has some manners," said my father to no one in particular. "Perhaps we should carve the goose," said my boyfriend, rifling through the pile of silverware on the table. "Where's the knife?" he asked. I remember an infomercial for a set of knives, their blades fortified with diamond powder. They were advertised as the only knives you'll love to need to love, etc. In the advertisement, anonymous hands wielded shiny, shiny blades that chopped through butter and animal bone as if they were the same thing, through ice and tendon and untreated wood, as if there was no difference between anything in the world. Only a slight variation in grain, visible once something has been split in half. All eyes turned toward me, and it was at this moment that I realized I was in my own house, and these things were my things. "I just don't know," I said to everything. At that moment, men were beginning to file into the room from somewhere else. They took positions in the corners of the rooms or in strategic corridors. Strange furnishings, they filled the space without filling the silence. They shuffled and stared. Their silence had an eagerness. "Won't you introduce us?" they said. I began to form a sentence beginning, "These are," but I lacked the words to complete it. "Who are you?" I asked. "We're your boyfriends, partners, paramours," they responded in a broken chorus. I thought I would go first to check on the door. I must have forgotten to shut it. More might come if I didn't close it quickly. There was a tension between the demands of the suitors and the capacities of the home, the structure of furnishings, plates, food that I had woken into. At the same time, there was a strange reciprocity between them, as the presence of a suitor seemed to demand the performance of hospitality, even as the presence of surplus plates, chairs, napkins, seemed to draw more strangers into the house. I arrived to find the entryway empty, save for a man in what appeared to be a uniform stepping across the threshold. "I'm just the postman," he said. "Oh," I said, "please come in." "Since you broke up with me," he finished. Oh, I said. There was a stiff feeling in the air. If only I could remember one thing about him, I could say it out loud. Nice shirt, I said. Yes, since you broke up with me, he said. There was a hazy, damp film in his eyes that I recognized from emotions in old movies, projected large on darkened screens. But then, you'd hardly remember, would you? He said bitterly.
The second part of Fairy Tale by Alexander Kleeman, read by the author, when the Paris Review podcast continues.
What sort of a person was I? I had a rich store of memories, recent ones and much older ones, their edges rubbed smooth over time. I could remember that I was certified to perform CPR, and that I spent summer afternoons in third grade swimming at the quarry, where they sold ice cream bars shaped like the heads of cartoon animals. But I had no idea who this person might be, or who any of the people might be who sat at that table and watched me at the door and claimed to have feelings not exactly for me, but at me. When they smiled, the skin around their eyes and mouths bunched up. I had the distinct sense they were all made of the same material by someone who owned a big bolt of fleshy cloth. At some point, I must have met them, loved them, had fine times. But now all they evoked was a sense of responsibility, a vague and resentful crest. When I led this new man back to the table, the suitors had already begun to compete in earnest. I'm her fiancé, one said. I'm her boyfriend, said another. Me too, said the third. They glared at one another across the table, and one took a roll from another's plate and ate it with anger. There doesn't have to be a conflict between those things, I said hopefully. They glared at me. Was I going to have to choose? Here, now, in front of all these people in an exposed and public scene? And if they made me choose, how could I? I didn't know anything about any of them. In fact, I could barely tell them apart. When I looked at them, I struggled to note subtle differences in hairstyle, which I cross-referenced to well-known television actors with distinct names that I applied mentally to each suitor for sorting purposes, though I kept these names within quotation marks to remind myself they were only temporary. Patrick, David, Jason, Rob, Michael, Marco, Carl? Jack? Most of the time when I looked at them, I couldn't even see their faces, or if they had faces. Was this love? I turned to my mother. I wanted to ask, couldn't I just choose none of them? Swiveling her head sharply, she gave me a look with her lips tightened. She breathed quickly in and out, nostrils flared. I knew the answer would be no. The structural similarity of men and their ability to be represented both as ideal, like the Vitruvian of Da Vinci, and as average. Man being the measure of all things and therefore a sort of standard and interchangeable unit of length, breadth, intelligence, emotion. We could lay them end to end to measure the distance between the continents, the distance to the moon. We could use them to calculate the weight of the weather, or to buy things at the grocery store. With such an abundance of men, we could gauge anything we chose. I knew I was behaving badly. I could barely attend to the words on the sonic level. The suitor on the left, who kept trying to hold my hand, I had offended by replacing my hand and his with a dinner roll. As they went around the table listing nouns and adjectives that corresponded somehow to whole persons, I tried to focus my thinking not on the world of men, the superfluity of men, the community of men, or their etiquette and social contracts, but on men in the particular, men replete with difference. "All right," said my mother, "whom will you be choosing?" "Well, he brought flowers," I said, pointing at the one who had brought flowers. The flowers in their wrapping gave off a trapped and fragrant odor. "It's true," he said, standing up. "And I have to confess, I love you very much. I think you're perfect for me. But I will tell you something soon that will make you wish you could change your mind." "Why don't you step into the kitchen to talk this through?" my father suggested. "It sounds personal." "Okay," I said. He took me by the elbow and directed me out of the room, turning back briefly to wink roguishly at the table of parents and men that watched us still. I tried to wave or gesture as an apology for my own lapse of manners, but with his thumb on the inner joint and his palm wrapped firmly around the back, I found I could do little more than wriggle the limb. In the kitchen, he turned to me and held me close. He brushed a strand of hair from my face and traced the jawline with two long fingers. "And you?" he asked, smiling softly. "How are you feeling, my darling?" "I'm confused," I answered. "Yes, yes," he said thoughtfully. "You want to know my feelings, my constitution. You want to know that I care about you. You want assurances that I love you, that I think of you deeply," he said. I thought about this, which seemed less than I actually wanted to know, but also a step toward knowing anything at all. "That sounds good," I said. "Well, yes, it sounds good," he replied, chuckling. "And it is most certainly true. But it should also be known to you, as it is known to me, that I came here with the intent to kill you." "What?" I asked. "Also, I came here to kill you," he clarified. He was already rooting around in the kitchen drawers, looking for a knife to put through my chest. It wasn't the right time to bring this up. Maybe there would be a right time later. "Are you really the only person who doesn't have a knife? Any knife of any sort in their kitchen?" he asked with a note of irritation in his voice. "That's what it looks like," I said. I meant this in an earnest way, free of sarcasm, but I could tell I was sounding like a bitch. "Listen to you two. You sound like an old married couple," said a suitor who had wandered into the kitchen by accident. He chuckled to himself. "Help me," I said to him. "Help you what?" he answered. "Escape from this guy," I said, "who is trying to kill me." "Help you, please, is what I was waiting to hear," said the suitor wryly. A few feet away, my killer looked at his watch. The man I had chosen was going to find something sharp and come after me and stab me with it. He would not tell me his reasons, and in the meantime, I would have to tell him mine, my reasons for not wanting to be stabbed. Being stabbed would interfere with the general harmony of my body, with its function, with its status as self-containing vessel, whole and protective. It would interfere with my nervous system and my circulatory system, with my respiratory system, and to a lesser extent, my immune system. It would spring a leak in me. It would leave me open to the world. The helpful suitor, in the meantime, had located a door to another room. "In here," he said. Now we were in here. In here was my bedroom, still decorated with a poster of Minnie Mouse that I had owned since middle school. Didn't I ever get rid of anything? Had I been born into this house? And had I ever left it? "Lock the door," I said. "Like this?" he said, wriggling the knob. "No, lock it," I said. "Lock it so it can't be opened," I explained further. He looked distracted. "Use the lock," I said more sharply and loudly. "You don't have to snap at me," he said. I went to the lock and turned it, but it went around and around. He had found the only room in the house with a non-functional lock. I heard footsteps coming slowly up the stairs. Then the one I had chosen burst into the room. He was holding an armful of things he had found in the linen closet, which I assumed he was planning to use as weapons. First, he took an armful of mixed towels and washcloths and attempted to drive them into my back. Then he grabbed a collapsible laundry hamper and threw it in the direction of my head. He picked up some containers of fabric softener and lobbed them at me, and then tried repeatedly to jam a feather duster through my chest. He picked up a long cushion that had come from the couch. At this rate, it would take forever. He paused, breathing heavily. "Okay, look," he said. "I give up. I love you, and I don't remember why I'm trying to kill you. Can we just start over?" I thought about it. "What would we do?" I asked. "We could watch a movie," he suggested. I didn't know what to say. I knew I had a big choice to make. I could let it all go and try to love him, try to trust him, try to make something lasting and good. He obviously had strong feelings for me or about me. And he wasn't being so bad right now. We could build something strong, beautiful. Or I could try to make a dash for the door by crawling under the dining room table. There was a good chance he would kill me later, either way. I dove under the table and scrambled toward the door. He was still behind me, cursing over the fallen chairs that lay before him and the 10-foot lead I had. But when I reached for the knob, it wouldn't turn. The lock was on the outside. Who ever heard of the lock for a door being on the outside? It would be up to another, possibly a total and complete stranger, to decide whether you'd ever be allowed to leave. I knew it was time to run again. He was looking around the room for a better weapon, and he would probably find it. I was so tired. I just wanted to curl up with someone, anyone. Even him, and sleep until work on Monday. I wanted to feel someone's, anyone's hands on me, even if it was in that way I hate, the fingers all over my face and jaw.
One instinct of fear is to try to make oneself as little, as unnoticeable as possible, to cower, as one thinks, unseen and anonymous until the hunt is past. My fearful instinct is to bloat myself.
Okay, how did you get here tonight?
I had therapy at 4:30 on Fifth Avenue, about 20 blocks south of here. And in fact, I showed up in this suit for therapy, and my therapist looked alarmed immediately as soon as I walked in. But all I had to do was walk 20 blocks here from there, so I got here by foot.
What is your usual therapy uniform? I don't even know if that's a good question to ask a person.
I'm totally inconsistent. sometimes plaid button-down shirts, sometimes black sweaters and corduroys. I try to blend an air of responsibility with one of spontaneity.
I think that works really well.
Thank you.
The Woe Shirt, fiction by Paulet Barton. Belem did Tinker repair his bicycle by the stink-toe tree. Better to work there, it smells so bad. Work gets done no lazy quick. Then he rode to buy a Woe shirt. He saw Mari then, standing. She said, "You going to buy that shirt, I know. You'll go buy that beggar shirt, Belem, I know. Oh, it'll cost you all your little money, all your goats and old friend Parrot to get it. I tell you clearly, look at what you do. Spend everything on a beggar shirt, no sense." But Mari saw that Belem felt the shirt on him already, too late. "Okay then, say goodbye twice to your Parrot," she said. Belem said, "Goodbye, I go begging. I'll have a Woe shirt to beg in soon." Twice he said this to his parrot. The parrot blink and green flutter the air and nibble fruit. Said nothing back. They walked the bicycle to the Woe shirt closet set up in the marketplace. Closet with all the market for a house around it. The shirt seller there looked at Belem's tattered shirt and he said, "Take your choice." Belem looked at all the shirts then and asked advice of Mari which to choose. Mari said, "None." She said more, "Buy some thread and needle if you want to spend." Belem saw on the shirts memories he knew of things familiar. He said to Mari, "Look, there's that day on this shirt, that day we saw bark scrolling up on the eucalyptus trees." Mari saw that day sewn there on the shirt, and she said, "Yes, I remember." She looked squint and wary at the shirt seller, looking away from her he was. Belem then, "And here on this shirt, that night we saw the moon and the moon-shaped cloud next to it. Out walking we were and saw them." Mari said, "Just like the eyes of the favorite goat of yours. Lovely eyes next to each other like the moon and the moon-shaped cloud. I remember. That goat stumbled a lot, but those eyes. You could never sell that goat, no." Belem saw days passed, all sewn on the shirts. He felt sad, old, and wanted all the shirts to wear on him those times over again. Mari said, "Belem, you remember good by forgetting bad. And the other way around. Some memories spin your heart sad, some happy," she said. "But when it stops, you still standing here, ready to buy this Woe shirt, still. Buying these rich memories will be making you poor, Belem." She knew how these things work. Belem was trying on the shirts. Mari said, "You are stubborn for a shirt, Belem friend. You don't look in your face well. It's a certain kind of fever for a shirt. You got this." But Belem did buy a shirt then. He bought his favorite shirt with Mari sewn on it, sitting on a dock, braiding garlic, practicing for her daughter's hair, braiding. All this was sewn on the shirt, and Belem remembered it well. He bought this one. "That's a memory, rich memory," he said. Then he went begging in the market. Mari, she turned back to see the shirt seller begin sewing fast. On a new shirt, he sewed Belem begging in the market. A picture of that he sewed. Mari stopped to look. He held the shirt up for her to look.
Thank you.
Grocers and cobblers and rents and rents until I bleed. After I've finished what I'm now working on, I may have to give up writing altogether. My need, as I imagine it, to write may be all conceit. The bellows that fan the little flicker is nothing but wind, after all. Ah, my endless bleating of private woes, because I am not allowed to write. As though the trees would grow inward like toenails if I renounce this passion for self-glorification. Peace, let me write. Gag the tradesman, I must write. Alms for the love of writing. But even this momentary disgust I blame upon the weather. And even this disgust is material for writing, just as trees and toenails and glorification and teeth. I think it's time to stop this. I wanted at first only to say that I am profoundly ashamed of my silence and of my broken promises, and that I will not fail you again, and that I do, with all the bloody muscle of my heart, ask for your forgiveness. I want one day to write you a happy letter, because I am very often happy, and not always here by the sea without cause. Please forgive me and try to trust me again. The old cold pool of the day is a little warmer now. Yours ever, Dylan.
That concludes the Paris Review Podcast, Episode 15, Memory, Rich Memory. The pieces that you heard in this episode are Mea Culpa, a letter from Dylan Thomas to his publisher, Marguerite Caetani. It was written in 1952 and appeared in the Paris Review, Issue 128, Fall 1993. It was read by
Salman Rushdie.
Thanks to Judith, who sent us the recording of the birds outside Dylan Thomas's actual boathouse in Carmarthenshire, Wales. Mea Culpa appears courtesy of the Dylan Thomas Trust. For more information, visit discoverdylanthomas.com. The Solution, a poem written and read by
Sharon Olds.
It appeared in issue 96, summer 1985. Fairy Tale, a story written and read by
Alexandra Kleeman.
It appeared in issue 195, winter 2010. You also heard The Woe Shirt, a story by Paulet Barton, which appeared in issue 78, summer of 1980. It was performed by musician and Paris Review subscriber
Devendra Benhart.
And thanks to David Flores for the interview with the wearer of the therapy suit, recorded in 2019 at the Paris Review's Spring Revel. This podcast is a co-production of The Paris Review and Stitcher. Our production team includes
John Delore,
Brendan Francis Noonan of Public Address Media,
Helena de Groot,
Craig Morgan Teicher,
Lori Dorr,
and me, Emily Nemens. This episode was mixed and sound designed by Hannes Brown and Brendan Francis Noonan, featuring original music composed and performed by a talented ensemble that includes David Sieri, Emily Wells, Mike Brown, Sam Ospavat, Rob Schwimmer, Shazad Ismaili, and Casey Holford. Our theme song is composed by David Sieri. Our advisory board members are Ijeoma Azoto, Alexander Chi, Glory Edom, Haley Gates, and Tony Ann Fernandez. We had production assistance from Ashley Warren. Special thanks to Daisy Rosario and Chris Bannon, the Chief Content Officer at Stitcher, and everyone over at TPR HQ. A very special thanks to Hendrix Gin, the presenting sponsor of Season 2 of the Paris Review podcast. Oddly infused with rose and cucumber, Hendrix Gin. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, and while you're at it, please leave us a review. And if you want to read any of the pieces in this episode, subscribe at theparisreview.org. You'll get access to our 66-year digital archive, new essays on the Paris Review Daily, and the very best in new poetry, fiction, art, and interviews. a beautiful journal delivered straight to your door 4 times a year. Thanks for listening.
Stitcher.